It's Friday, June 16th, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and each week I talk to our capital muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Last weekend, big contrast between reality-based politics and fantasy-based politics. It was the People's Summit versus anti-Sharia protests. Political tactics become the subject of heated discussion on the left. Republicans shot at baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia. The shooter's apparent progressive politics raises the specter of a crackdown against anti-Trump protests. Victim blaming and false equivalences dominate discussion about a confrontation between LGBTQ protesters and a big white troll. In the absence of effective political power, we should expect more people to say enough. Today, we're reflecting on the strategies and tactics of protest. But we close out the day with a little space news, beer, and summer plans. Because, you know, it's been a big week. Elon Musk gives his vision for a permanent city on Mars. How about that? And the biggest question facing a sustainable city on Mars will certainly be whether or not we can brew beer in space. We'll find that out later this year. Reminder to tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'll be there giving a weekly resistance report once again. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, and with the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, don't worry about it. Go to the ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon on the sidebar. You can get the shows right there and stream it at your leisure. We want to remind you that we need you to keep Pull No Punches progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click Become a Member and you're on your way. Not ready to become a member? Not a problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking Donate. We need you. Let's face it, the progressive community, to help us deepen Pull No Punches progressive media that will hold power accountable. And this month, we have got a special membership offer through the month of June, maybe even into July. We'll see how this goes. If you become a member of Raging Chicken Press at the $15 a month level or above, we will send you Naomi Klein's brand new book, No Is Not Enough. And frankly, if you've been to our site, ragingchickenpress.org, anytime soon, you'll notice that on the right-hand side of the site, we've got a big picture of Naomi Klein's new book, No Is Not Enough. And we're going to, frankly, promote it aggressively because this is the book, in my mind, that the left needs to be reading right now. The idea that we have to start thinking about organizing, that we have to think about what it means to actually build power, not simply just stand up and get into the streets and say no, but then what? Then what? How do we build power? And these are exactly the kind of questions that, you know, we're going to be talking about on today's podcast and elsewhere. So I want to give a special shout out to Linda, who became a member at the $15 a month level. She will be getting Naomi Klein's new book, No Is Not Enough, plus some really cool stickers and potentially some car magnets. Right. We'll see when they come in and how they look and that kind of stuff. So that's pretty cool. Remember, we need you to become a member of Raging Chicken, help support this work and help pay our members, or pay our writers rather. Because remember, this is what, you know, Raging Chicken, in terms of this, the cost of the site, the server hosting and all that kind of stuff, that's mostly coming out of my pocket, right? That's mostly me kind of supporting all this stuff. Our membership program is designed almost entirely to kind of be funneled toward our writers, right? To begin paying our writers more. We are almost at the 50% mark for our goal. If we hit that goal of $150 a month on Patreon, then, well, we're going to be able to pay our writers more. So all we need is a few more people to hit that threshold, and then we'll meet our first goal. They'll be on to our next one. So become a member today of Raging Chicken Press and help build this progressive media infrastructure that, you know, that we've been building around. We'll have a little bit more to talk about that later on in the show when we talk about the last weekend's Planned Parenthood celebration. And that I was at, had some great feedback from some folks from that event, and about how necessary and how important it is the work that we do, which was great to hear. But we need your support now more than ever. To become a member of RagingChickenPress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and you'll be on your way. So, Sean, what's going on, man?
Oh, not much. Just had a big week out here in Harrisburg, I guess you can say.
A big week, yeah. Do tell.
Well, I guess I guess we could start off with Saturday, you know, with the anti-fascist and March Against Sharia that happened out here.
Yeah, let me give like just a little bit of a context just for folks if you weren't paying that much attention this past weekend. So what Sean is going to talk about, what happened in Harrisburg, that these were happening in about two dozen cities across the country, these kind of anti-Sharia marches, right? And this is kind of, you know, this is concerning to me on a bunch of different levels, right? Number one being that this is like these anti-Sharia marches are protests against sheer fantasy and fear-mongering, right? The idea that there is any kind of organized like group of like conspirators attempting to impose Sharia law on the United States is like just one notch away from complete insanity, like off the hook, off the flat earth insanity kind of stuff. So about two dozen cities, and it's done. They were organized by this group called Act America. And I have to say, there were a few years ago, the first time I ever heard about this organization, was I had a student, right? A extraordinarily smart student who had basically started writing her research paper about this movement, right? And it was in a class that was about social movements and things like this. So, you know, it's fair game. But I had no idea. So she starts reporting on this, and she had learned about this through her churches, right? This woman who runs Act for America had been going around from church to church, shopping this kind of like, you know, the Muslims are coming. Sharia law is taking over our communities in the silent, you know, during the silent night or so on. And so the fact that we've gone from like, you know, crazy kind of people at the edge of reality now kind of organizing protests across the country in this Trump, you know, this Trump organization era was pretty frightening. So that's going on nationally, right? These small, I mean, relatively small like protests, but still across the country. And then we've got the contrast with the People Summit out there in Chicago dealing with kind of very clear, you know, reality-based politics. So anyways, that's kind of the context. I should probably have said that right off from the get-go, but that's kind of the context nationwide. And Sean was on the ground there in Harrisburg as these kind of stuff unfolded. And I think this is the reason why we're going to devote so much to today's show to talk about strategies and tactics and look at some of this stuff specifically, is because there's some really important questions that were put on the table that, you know, we need to have some, you know, really, I don't know, serious and real discussions about. So anyway, yeah. Sorry for that, Sean, but, you know, so take us to Saturday.
So to add on top of that, right, the discussions I've seen coming afterwards from people within our own community, you know, sort of like laughing off the organizations that were there, like the Oath Keepers, or laughing off the fact that these people are cowards, or that the anti-fascists are cowards because they cover their face, or they don't know who the anti-fascists are. I think it's like really an important conversation that I think we should have. And the history and the traditions that's been going on within these movements, especially the anti-fascist movement, which has been around for about 100 years now. It's a lot more active over in Europe, and some other countries actually dealt with fascism back in the 1940s.
And a few, right?
And the reason why they cover their faces is so they're not spotted. They don't get, so it's like reconnaissance. So the other side doesn't know who you are. So if you're walking down the street one day, you're not spotted by someone, some skinhead, you know, because for your anti-fascist activities. Out here in Harrisburg, we have a lot of, you know, hate groups. There's Identity Europa is getting started off out here. There's a group called the West Shore Boys. You know, there are hate groups that are popping up, and in response, the anti-fascists are showing up to their demonstrations as Black Bloc or as, you know, people from the Democratic Socialist of America. You know, some there were some DSA members out here. There were two separate confrontations that happened, and one of them was with the Black Bloc members, people all dressed in black with their faces covered. And then there was the other one that happened on Second Street with, you know, your local socialists who didn't have their faces covered, and they physically blocked them from completing their march. So with that being said, you know, I got up, got out, was on Second Street, on State Street by like 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday or Saturday morning, right? Mm-hmm. Met up with some the anti-fascists that I know, Black Bloc members that I know from the community. We were talking, and I saw where they met. But one of the things that was really stunning was the amount of reconnaissance and the amount of security that the anti-fascist, you know, that the neo-Nazi groups had, right? The Oath Keepers were out, right, in their military garb. You know, people walking around with walkie-talkies, with sidearms on their legs, with guns on them, doing reconnaissance, not just around the Capitol perimeter, but also throughout downtown Harrisburg.
Yeah, so let me stop just so people know, right? The Oath Keepers, like if you're not already aware, the Oath Keepers are this, you know, it's basically a paramilitary organization, right? The oath that they're supposed to be keeping is an oath to the Constitution. But these folks are, you know, they follow in the tradition of these right-wing paramilitaries. There's a lot of ex-military folks that are members of the Oath Keepers. That's not to say that anyone in the military is like automatically be Oath Keeper. The idea is that the Oath Keepers themselves have, you know, ex-cops, ex-police officers, ex-military that are there, and they operate like that, right? So they show up around, you know, very specific kind of marches, fully armed, right? They're armed, like you could see in pictures that Sean had posted to the internet this week, where they have their sidearms there. In many cases, that they have, you know, semi-automatic weapons that they're carrying around with them.
I have took other pictures, you know, going through my photos I took. They're walking around with like billy clubs wrapped around their wrist. These people were heavily armed. Also, the people in the march, you know, the anti-Sharia march, they had American flags duct taped or tied to three quarters or full axe or full length axe handles. You know, you basically using them as clubs, disguising them as clubs. You know, these people were marching with the intent of if they got into a brawl, they were going to use these weapons.
Right.
And so this happened on Saturday morning. Also, so when I was there taking pictures of people in the crowd, was able to find out who else was there. There was a hate group called Sons of Odin. This is a hate group that started, anti-immigrant group that started out in Finland. They were there. They showed up. They were out there on that side. There was also another group called Vanguard America that was there. You could look at their flag. It looked like the Mockingjay from Hunger Games. Literally, if we're going to be talking about the Hunger Games and how, you know, we're going to be living in a Hunger Games economy pretty soon. They're similar to the Hunger Games, but also carrying a Roman fascist. And for those of you who don't know, the Roman fascist was a symbol used on the Italian fascist flag. A Roman fascist is a axe that is wrapped around a bundle of sticks. And it was a weapon used by the people who protected the guard or protected the emperor. And whoever stepped out of line would get beat with that axe or they would get killed with it.
Right. And this was actually where the word fascism comes from, right? I mean, this is the origin of that term fascism. It comes from that symbol that was used particularly in Italy. So,
yeah. So these are the type of symbols that they were using. you know, the tactics that the Black Bloc was using anytime a protester or anti-Sharia protester was marching up the street, they would blockade the street. They would force them to either have to physically walk through their blockade or go around the corner, you know, go outside of the security perimeter to get to the other side. other observations of what I seen there or what I was talking to people, there were at least 30 to 33 visible Oath Keepers. There were as many as 100 to 150 there. They had their own cavalry, literally their own cavalry off to the side of the Capitol, ready to fight in case a street fight broke out between the two groups. These people were there with the intent of starting both. I mean, they were there with the intent of if a fight happened, there was going to be a large street fight.
Right.
you know, just to say the anti-fascists, these aren't usually normally peaceful events. no windows were broken. Only two arrests were made. One was a juvenile who kind of like pushed an agitator out of the way. I wouldn't even say he pushed him. He laid hands on him. And then right away, the police officers arrested this person for touching the agitator. And then there was also a questionable arrest on the march. Afterwards, the anti-fascist group, the Black Bloc group, went out marching. I was maybe out. The police had their the state troopers had their horses out, and as a way to stop marchers from marching in the streets, they charged their horses into the crowd and forced people on there. Allegedly, one of the protesters that was arrested had a spike on their 2x4, their black flagpole, and they hit a horse with that. And that was one of the pictures we got of the state trooper pointing out the person and also making the arrest.
I'm telling you, this is this kind of situation concerns me, Sean. I mean, I think, you know, I was looking at it was kind of a lead up to the show today and a little bit last night. I was looking up at some of the images that emerged from these kind of anti-Sharia protests across the country and that have been on the increase, I would say, particularly as you have these kind of right-wing marches. And, you know, you have – there's this one guy. I'm sure you've seen him, right? They've dubbed him Captain America, right, who's kind of like dresses with this like Captain America shield and has this kind of stuff. He's this kind of right-wing guy who carries this long pole with like a spike on the end, you know, as a way of kind of say we're going to do combat. And that's been – we're going to do combat with, you know, whatever, the left in the street or something like this. There's been an increasing number of these right-wing protesters who have taken that up and now are wearing these kind of like, you know, donning themselves in the American flag and Captain America things, basically claim this, even though Captain America was an anti-fascist icon for the longest time, but that's, take that out of the picture. But also some of them had these, you know, that, you know, pseudo-Roman helmets, right? Like, or Spartan helmets that they were wearing as part of their marches. And, you know, when I see people gearing up for battle, so that's the one side, right? And then in the absence, from my perspective at least, in the absence of any effective political organization on the left, right, not just people, you know, mobilizing out in the street and protesting, but I mean effective mobilization or organization to combat some of these, the kind of anti-immigrant racist stuff that's coming out of the Trump organization and affiliates and this kind of emergent right-wing neo-fascist group, you know, basically saying we are going to stop them in their tracks because the law's not doing it. Politics are not doing this. We've let these people in the power. Now we're standing up and we're going to say enough. And you have these direct confrontations, right? I mean, now you have, I saw a whole lot of stuff that was talking about what happened in Harrisburg. There's a lot of attention that was being paid to the Black Bloc protesters who had flags on wooden poles, right? And said, look, well, they have bats. They have bats. No, they weren't bats, right? But basically saying that, look, they're bringing weapons too, right? Wanted to say that this is about kind of these fights in the streets. But whether or not that's an intention or not, when you see this kind of unfold in city after city, this really sets the stage for some potentially really violent confrontations to come, which reminds me of the 1920s, what we saw over in Europe with this kind of emergent fascism.
And one of the things that I would, you know, like to make observations of, some of the people who I know who are in these groups, I know them just from the neighborhood. They were not thinking like this a year ago, you know, to join an anti-fascist group.
Right.
You know, like there's not any political organizing going on out here. And these are the groups people are gravitating towards. Not going to say it's right, not going to say it's wrong, but you know, I think we have to rethink our responses. You know, is holding a community unity event a mile or two away from the center of the action going to be enough? And these are kind of the arguments that are happening, or there are discussions that are going to be happening that have to happen now with these events. I, for one, am not, I'm somewhere in the middle of the anti-fascist. I'm not a Black Bloc. I don't support breaking property. I don't support throwing bricks through windows, stuff like that. But I'm also not, you know, the one thinking that these like unity events are going to help stop like this political organizing. You know, you had members from the DSA come out and there was a couple videos posted online of them where they physically blocked people from marching in the street. You know, no masks on. They were in their jeans. Some of them had their union colors on and this was the action that they took.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, when I was organizing with, you know, global justice stuff down, you know, like 1999, early 2000s in D.C., when we were doing the IMF World Bank protest and that kind of stuff, which we were, you know, actively planning on shutting down the city, right? I worked actively with a lot of, you know, folks who were kind of what were Black Bloc folks, right? I frankly, you know, they raise questions as part of those organizing, the organizing sessions and things like this, which are absolutely imperative, right? About what's going to be the effectivity of kind of what we do and how we do this. Now, I'm with you in terms of breaking property and things like this is not my bag, and frankly, I think that's primarily because I think in terms of political effectivity, there's more damage done than otherwise. I'm not a fan of this whole idea of escalation, like the idea that you need to make things worse and somehow that's going to make it better. I don't believe that. History doesn't show that. I think it has a lot more to do with impatience and frustration about getting things done, which I think is justifiable. So anyways, what kind of my point being there is that these are real questions. I think when people are seeing, like, you know, their communities attacked, and it's especially in kind of younger white communities, I think this has been the case. And this is where you tend to see a lot of Black Bloc stuff, where, you know, white folks are being called to task, basically saying, what are you going to do? Right. In the face of emergent racism, right. In the face of emergent fascism, what's your role? Right. And is it just saying, oh, this is unfortunate, this is bad, that's not enough? You need to kind of stand up and move forward. There was that whole discussion earlier this year with the safety pin stuff. Right. Is that you have that safety pin as a symbol of sanctuary. Right. Well, what does that mean exactly? Are you just going to put the safety pin on there so you can feel good as a person? Right. Or are you prepared to actually take people into your homes, into your office space and things like this to actually protect them? Right. And this is part of that kind of, discussion about, what will I do? And I think there's people that are saying, look, we have to stop these people. There's people that have read history and say that, you know what? One of the things that we cannot allow is that we cannot allow the emergent fascism, right-wing nationalism to seem normal in any stretch of the imagination, right? We cannot allow us to stand by and assume that this is just like any other group that has other things to say in our political discourse. No, this is a group and an organization which is about white dominance, right, of people, wants to kill Muslims, wants a white supremacist future, right? And we have to stop them because we've learned from history. And I think this is the kind of question.
And they're making the same arguments that the Nazis made before they became political power,
exactly,
going after,
right,
scapegoating Jewish people in Germany.
That's exactly right, Sean. And I think, you know, this is what we talked a little about this last week, right? The Timothy Snyder's book, Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, right? And that first lesson, which he kind of say, and I'll say it again here, was, you know, he said, look, without this first one, without abiding by this rule, everything else doesn't matter. And what he said, and this was it, do not obey in advance. Most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts to this way is teaching power what it can do. In other words, if people are going out and marching in the streets and saying the most hateful things, they are learning, right, that this is going to be acceptable, and they're going to constantly push those limits. Because, like, right now, I think that's where we're at. And so the idea about blockading streets, right, is about that withdrawal of consent, right? We say we are not going to agree. We are not going to consent in advance to the rise of fascism. And once you're at that point, then you say, okay, what are the means by which we get to respond to this, right? Now, if we had, just as an example, if we had a strong and militant labor movement, right, the response could very much be, we are going to go on a general strike, right? We are going to stand in the streets and we are not going to allow this to happen. And we are not going to allow the machinery of society to function, right, until this is stopped by our politicians, through our legislation, and so on, right? That's number one. If we have that militant kind of like labor movement, which we do not in this country, although there's like little sparks of it here and there, or if we had a political party, right, that actually had the interest, right, of deep-rooted democracy at its core. We do not. The Democratic Party, at this point, they have maybe have, you know, their people moving in that direction, but they are not organized, right, as something to defend the vast majority of working people in this country, right? So we have no political party that is capable of responding to this stuff right now, and we do not have any kind of organized, like a militant labor movement, organized a political group like in this country to respond to that. And so we should expect, in my mind, a very uneven and potentially not comfortable pathway forward here as people attempt to respond to what they see, and I think justifiably, right, as the kind of resurgence of kind of neo-fascism.
And one of the things that you know, was scary seeing how organized these people are. What was equally as scary was the conversations that were had afterwards and after we posted our photos and, you know, our story and everything about how people were just laughing off these groups, saying, oh, these are oath keepers instead of oath keepers. You know, these are the, you don't have to worry about them. They're not going to do anything like that. But, you know, I was talking about this with Roxbury in a newsroom and a couple of other journalists. You know, there was no media presence there for this, right? Penn Live sent the intern out, and the photographer who was there from Penn Live was actually supposed to be somewhere else, and he just happened to stumble upon this. Like, holy shit, I'm going to stay here and take pictures of this.
Right.
You know, like, there was going to be no, like, mainstream coverage of this event in the area because it was a weekend, and they don't have weekend staffs anymore. But Roxbury and I were talking about this, you know, seeing how organized these right-wing groups were that were there, especially the Oath Keepers, you know, having 100, 150, possibly 200 people there. Doing reconnaissance and walking around downtown Harrisburg as if they were on their own police force and doing reconnaissance and surveillance on things. They weren't just like in the Capitol perimeter. They were walking downtown. I was walking with some people from the Black Block. I turned around to go back towards the river, and I see a couple of Oath Keepers like walking towards me.
Mm-hmm.
You know how scary that is? You're walking away from the event and you see a couple of those people walking towards you.
Right.
You know what I did? I just turned right around and went right back up State Street. It seemed as if the Capitol Police who were there were happy that these people were there. It was actually as if they were, because it was like they brought their own security force with them. You know, that was something that just blew my mind. You know, it was almost like they were cordial in their responses and talking to them. There is also the Strawberry Square. You know where that's at in Harrisburg?
Yeah. Yep.
There's also talks of these paramilitary groups bag checking people walking into Strawberry Square.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that online. There was actually some discussion about that. I was like, man, this is not good.
I mean, like, this is how the level organized people. This is how organized these groups are, and the people on the left, especially in these indivisible groups, these local community groups, shouldn't laugh these people off. They should take this as a serious threat.
Look, I mean,
which is the conversations that I've seen that were had, laughing these people off as if they were no big deal at all.
No, I agree. And look, and, you know, again, I'll keep on promoting this book too as well. I mean, you know, the Timothy Snyder book. I mean, he's people should listen to the interview that he gave on the Majority Report. I think it was like last week or the week before, talking about how these things emerge. And read some stuff on authoritarianism, and you can kind of see, look, this is the steps that we're going in that kind of direction, right? So, for example, what happened if, you know, with the famous like brown shirts in Germany and things like this, right? They became Hitler's, you know, thugs. They start off as thugs, right? Extra, you know,
paramilitary outside the government.
Exactly. Right. And so that the government can basically, you know, distance himself a little bit at the beginning, then they become sanctioned, right? Or approved. Right. By the group, even if it's just by initially just letting them be kind of what you're talking about, you know, oh, hey, like the Oath Keepers are here to help us out. That's great. Right. And then they become more official as part of that kind of like emergent fascist movement. And then they get the stamp of approval by power. Right. So you're moving these people from the outside and the in. Right. This is the whole idea about not giving your consent in advance to allow armed random individual. I mean, look, these people have been playing war for a long time. And I don't mean, you know, just the official military stuff. That's not playing war. That's real. But a lot of these folks, then they continue on and they join these, you know, They go on their camping tours and things like this, and they go off into the woods and they play war, right? And many of them, right, if you follow what happened, in the 1990s with the white militias up in Michigan, right? This got a lot of play back and then. It was the same deal, right? These folks would go away for the weekend, but instead of going hunting, they would be planning war games. I mean, they're doing war games and planning what's going to happen in terms of like the takeover of our government or pretending that our government is this fascist government. And at some point, for enough of these people, especially with right-wing media that is like the drumbeat behind all of this, eventually some of these folks start to think, oh my God, this is actually happening. Like, we're actually in this kind of emergent fascist government that we need to protect against, when really, they're the fascists, right? I mean, that's what's crazy about what's going on right now. And it was so concerning to see this going on, especially, you've got folks that are, like I said, the People Summit that was going out there in Chicago was such a contrast with this, because here you have actually people attempting to build and do the kind of nitty gritty work of politics. Meanwhile, you've got these, the war game players, right? Marching alongside the, pseudo Captain America, Sharia is coming, Red Dawn, Wolverines. And this is just like, I don't know even what to call this. I mean, I think it's got to be, at the very least in my lifetime, this is absolutely unprecedented to see this going on in this country. And you know what's crazy about, I'll say this now, is because this is it's the kind of thing that it doesn't feel great saying, right? It feels a little nutty to even be talking about this, right? In part because, like, you don't want to believe this is going to happen, right? You don't want to believe that this is a logical conclusion. But you can also see, again, the more I read about this stuff, when the way that people were talking about, the rise of fascism in Italy and in Spain and in Germany, beforehand, people didn't necessarily think this was going to happen either. You can't wait till it's too late. So on the one hand, it can sound kind of conspiratorial, like this stuff is going to, lead in very bad directions. On the other hand, we grow up hearing those who refuse to remember history are doomed to repeat it. Well, do we believe that or not? Right. Can we take lessons from history or not? And in my mind, someone who believes that we should, protect our freedoms, that we should protect our organizations, we should protect democracy, this is of concern to me. Because remember, fascism did not arise right from authoritarian states. It arose in many cases from democracies.
Yeah, no, it's 100% correct.
So crazy. I mean, so listen, so we talked a little bit about the anti-Sharia stuff. We'll take a little break. I want to come back and we'll get into this stuff that happened this bothers me. The LGBTQ community, right? You have this kind of rally and there's this altercation that takes place. And then we can talk a little about that. But I also want some of the discussion that you've been, we've been talking a lot about, and you've been kind of bringing to light about what the response has been with here. And so, which even points to the fact that we need a different way of even talking about our politics that does not kind of devolve into some sort of puritanical, this purity on one side or victim blaming on the other. But it's crazy. All right, so let's take a little bit of a break and we'll come back and we're going to continue this. We're going to get down into more deeply to see where the rabbit hole goes, folks. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Breast. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, Pinkerton detectives arrived at job sites across the U.S. to escort workers off the premises. No, it was not a railroad or a coal mine in labor's distant past. It was at the offices of what was once the largest computer seller in the United States. And the year was 2000. Inicom was filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The computer giant had been built on buying computers in large quantities and reselling them. But increasingly, computer manufacturers such as Dell began to sell directly to customers. They eliminated the middleman. Unable to adapt, Inicom's finances were a wreck. They brought in the Pinkertons to usher away employees and change the locks on the office doors. The Pinkertons arrived at the Atlanta office at 2:30. They showed up in Jacksonville at 4. Another former employee recalled his experience, saying, on June 16th, they came into the Buffalo office around 5 with Pinkerton security and a locksmith and said, basically, you've got 5 minutes to grab your personal belongings and leave the building. The bewildered employees were given few answers. The Pinkertons posted signs with an 800 number on the doors they had just locked. Then, at 4:26 p.m., more than 5,000 employees were sent an email from the company asking them to call that same number. When they did, a recorded message began to explain the events of the day. The employees learned that they would not receive their final paychecks, and they had all been fired. But the news got worse. The message went on, "We advise you begin exploring alternatives for medical and disability insurance." The message also said, "Intercom apologizes for the sudden disruption and expresses its appreciation for your dedicated service." Employees were left to scramble for new jobs and insurance without any warning whatsoever. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chickens Out the Coop podcast. So as we're coming up for the break, we're just kind of got to the point where we talk a little about the anti-Sharia protests and some of the issues that are coming there. But this past weekend, also, again, nationwide, traditionally, it's a weekend for the pride parades from the LGBTQ community, right? You have the big pride parades and celebrations across the country. This year, many, if not most of those protests or celebrations also became protests, right? So you had pride protests or pride actions and street demonstrations and kind of rallies became kind of much more connected to the resistance movement, right? And there were some very, very interesting discussions within those actions. I was thinking what happened in LA, right, which became overtly about, you know, resistance pride, right? Basically resisting to the Trump agenda. You saw this across the country, and you saw this in Harrisburg too as well. So on the one hand, we've got the anti-Sharia protests, but there was also the Equality March for Unity and Pride. It took place in Washington, D.C., and this was that was the main one in Washington, D.C., but then there was the solidarity marches that were taking place, like one that was there in Harrisburg, PA, which became the occasion for, one disturbing confrontation. That's number one, but even more disturbing kind of discussion afterwards. That, you know, Sean's been kind of right on this and been in, you know, in connection to the people who were involved in this. But Sean, first walk us through kind of what you witnessed, what you saw, kind of, or what, you know, what happened, and then we'll get into what happened, you know, the kind of response afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So I was not at the march. I was working when the march and the rally was going on afterwards. The local group that held it was the Central Pennsylvania LGBTQ Center, or the LGBTQ Center of Central Pennsylvania. And they held the march, and they held the event on the Capitol steps. And if you're familiar with the Capitol steps, there's a concrete divider on both sides that divides the grass from the steps, right? You know, you have like a little seating area as soon as you go up the first flight. There was a person there, a counter protester who's been seen in other events. Now it's come forward that he's been in other events wearing White Lives Matter t-shirts. This guy's like Neanderthal sized, like 6 foot, 350 pounds. He makes me look small, right?
He's a big guy.
Yeah. And he was there with a sign. Don't know what it really said, but a couple of people described the sign as like, illegal immigrants will bring incurable, gay immigrants are bringing incurable AIDS to the United States. Something like that. Like something we were talking about previously with like the far right bullshit that people are believing. Mm-hmm. This is what his sign was saying. He was also calling for another Pulse style mass shooting, which is the largest mass shooting in this country's history. And many of the victims were members of the LGBTQ community down in Orlando, Florida. Mm-hmm. And these protests happened on that 1 year anniversary of the Pulse shooting, the Pulse massacre. And he held his sign up. So what ended up happening is a lot of people there looks like they got fed up with him being there and they were waving their flags. They're drowning him out by holding their flags and holding their signs in front of this guy as a way of like drowning him out of the protest, or drowning his own protest out. And as he's walking off, a member from the LGBTQ community rips the signs out of this guy's hand. Mm-hmm. There's multiple videos of this up online. He then swings around, pushes the person off the concrete divider, and then continues to physically engage with this member of the trans community after they are pushed off the concrete divider. It looks like some punches are thrown, and he wants to get his sign back. So that happens. Then it's a very physical altercation. Our previous reporting stated that the Capitol Police actually threatened to arrest and charge the member of the trans community with robbery for taking the guy's sign, mm-hmm. not threatening to charge the guy with assault. No charges have been filed yet because this incident's still under investigation by the Capitol Police. This is, since it happened on the Capitol, it's under the Capitol Police's responsibility to file charges, not the city of Harrisburg or any other police force. Right. So it's Capitol Police that is strictly responsible for filing charges in this case. So afterwards, the discussion takes place in a lot of the Facebook groups and on social media was that this member of the trans community deserved what they got because they had the audacity to rip a sign full of hate speech out of this guy's hand. That yep. that taking a piece of paper out of someone's hand deserved an unequal show of force directed at them. And so then the victim blaming starts going around within the Harrisburg community.
Now, this is, you know, we talked a lot about this before we went on air today. What's troubling to me, well, first of all, you know, this goes back to what we're talking about at the beginning, like in the first segment, is that, you know, in the absence of any kind of like really like significant political opposition in an organization, there's going to be times where people are just going to have enough. Right. And in this situation, you know, you're talking about an anniversary of a hate crime massacre directed at the LGBTQ community in Orlando. Right. But that was, again, not in isolation. We should remember that also with Black Lives Matter movement. Right. If you read the Black Lives Matter manifesto, one of the things that is in there, it talks explicitly about the violence against the trans community, especially. Right. You're talking about the violence against gays and lesbians, bisexuals and transgendered folks across this country on a daily basis. Right. And now we've got a president, right, and an increasing, you know, political infrastructure, including in the state of Pennsylvania, that is overtly hateful to this community. Right. And at some point, right, and you're in that community and you're kind of been the target over and over again of this kind of hate, either physically, right, or through the, you know, what you see on TV and what you hear on an everyday basis. At some point you say, enough. I'm not going to sit there and allow this hate speech to be thrown back in my face by this Neanderthal, right? And I think that is what happened in this situation, right? That's what it looks like to me. That's what I've heard kind of, why did that person, right? Why did that person decide to take that sign away from that guy, right? And I think that's kind of what it is. I could totally understand that. Right. In that situation. So that's number one. We can have a discussion about whether that was right or whether it was not. But I think you need to put it in context. You think about what led up to that. Right. What were going to be the motivating factors that would allow somebody to be, not just someone being bratty. Right. Not just someone being like, hey, but someone who had had enough about being victimized by this kind of nonstop hate that we see being directed at their communities. That's number one. Now, we can have a discussion about is that an effective political tactic or whatever? But that is actually an abstract question, right? This is clearly not a situation in which you have like a group of people sat around and they plan, okay, listen, when we've got counter protesters that show up there, our strategy and our tactic will be to rip the signs away, right? This is a spur of the moment kind of stuff. So that's number one. But we can have a discussion. I think that's an important discussion to have, right? What is the kind of most effective way of kind of dealing with this stuff? And frankly, we talk about this all the time. Like, I work on a college campus, and we've had at Kutztown University where we've had fascist posters, neo-fascist posters, white supremacist posters on campus. This is an active discussion, right? I personally, right, think it is perfectly fine to rip those signs down when these kind of fascists and white supremacists put up these signs around campus, right? So that's kind of where I come down on that stuff. However, even if I believe that taking those things is justifiable, right, there will be consequences to, you know, to that kind of stuff. You might see that that's kind of worthwhile. Okay, so that's number one. Now you get a physical assault, right, by this guy, right, this huge guy, right, against a member of the trans community who's like half this guy's size, right, a physical assault and violent assault in here as a response. Right now, we can see these things. We have to understand taking a sign away, whether you think that was a good move or not, right, is not the same thing as being physically assaulted, right, by somebody twice your size, right? And what you described there, Sean, about the discussion that took place afterwards about, you know, this victim blaming, right, that this member of the trans community, right, they had it coming, right? They had it coming, took the sign. Well, what did they expect, right? Well, my guess is that it didn't go like this in that person's head. It didn't go like, okay, I'm going to take this sign away, right? The normal response to taking the sign away will be a physical beating, right? Therefore, I am going to take the sign away because I want the physical beating. That's insane, right? If we were talking about rape here and we put this same logic here, it would have a whole different tenor, right? Is it? If we were talking about, like, okay, you know,
They drank too much. They were expecting to get raped.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we could a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, it was, you know, too provocative of an outlet, right? Or, wait, like, she kissed him, right? So therefore, that meant.
That's or insane. She didn't have the proper clothes on.
Right. Exactly. I mean, all this kind of stuff. So what bothers me most about the discussion, especially as it's been taking place online, has been the, you know, the almost inability, right? Look, you expect the right-wing nut job hacks to kind of come out and basically and do that line of thing because that's what they believe to begin with, right? They're already horrible people to start with, right? But when you start seeing kind of liberals come out, right? Liberals come out and basically, you know, chastising, right, the member of the trans community for taking that sign away and basically, well, what did she expect or he expect or they expect, you know, in this kind of situation, when that is like the height of victim blaming at this point. I can't believe that we are in a situation where we are unable to kind of make these distinctions. But guess what? You know, this is in we live in that era of false equivalences, right? Where somehow, you know, the guy who is has a sign that is backed by centuries of systemic like oppression and violence, right, his action is put on the same level as someone who is fighting for inclusion, right, and demanding basic rights of equality of a human being. And somehow these things are the same, right? No. And that's how this discussion, you know, but that's not what the discussion is. Discussion is like, well, they had it coming. And that's insane. It's been disturbing, Sean, to see this play out.
Yeah, it's definitely been infuriating, to say the least. Angering.
Yeah, and I have to say, it's like, you know, if you go, you look at some of the discussions that's taken place in some of Sean's posts and on Raging Chicken about this story, you know, I am heartened in part by there are people who are, you know, starting to draw attention to this. But folks, you know, you might not agree with a particular tactic, right? You might say, like, look, it's not a smart thing to do to pull away a sign from a huge guy at a protest rally, okay? You might believe that. I'm not saying that that's not me. I'm just saying you might say that. That does not – if you believe that that was not a good move, right, for this person to do, pull that sign away, that does not mean that your next breath is therefore they deserved the physical assault, right? That does not necessarily follow. Right. We can say that, look, I don't think that was a great idea. And that guy was totally out of whack. Right. And in no cases should that be justified. right? Those two things.
What's really going to be interesting is now that this victim blaming frame is out there, what's going to happen when the state, you know, when the Capitol Police deny pressing charges against this man? Essentially, what this does is this endorses his actions.
That's
and
right.
It endorses his reactions, you know, when they decide not to press charges. Because I have doubt that they're going to press charges here. Member of a marginalized community gets assaulted, gets beaten. No, we'll just let it go. You know, if it was, you know, the disproportionate response, just, you know, going, seeing how the Capitol Police acted on Saturday compared to how they acted, let the guy walk free pretty much. It took him inside the Capitol building and he was able to walk free. Took down his information. I assume that's what they did. But there's an ongoing investigation. It's now been 5 or 6 days. How long does this investigation need to be? You have to question everyone that's there.
Right.
I mean, there are video cameras in every single one of those light poles, I can guarantee you, going up and down the Capitol steps.
Right.
Shouldn't be that long to see if you need to file charges or not, especially within this incident and the video angle that you saw.
Right. And especially, you know, reportedly that, you know, this transgendered individual, right, was threatened with arrest, right, for theft, right? I mean, you put that next to, well, what about this guy that just assaulted that person? And there's no threat there. And so, and here's my secondary concern, which kind of like ties a little bit into some, you know, other stuff that's happened in the news this week, is that this image, right, of this guy, quote unquote, defending himself, which is just absurd. I mean, anybody who like lives in the real world and thinks that this guy was defending himself, that's crazy. Okay. And I'm sorry, you're nuts if you believe this guy was just defending himself, right? And I have no problem if you hate my guts because I just said that, but that is true. If you think that is true, if you think this guy's defending himself, man, I don't know what world you're living in. Right. But you're not living in the reality based.
Well, they're living in the world where George Zimmerman's able to walk free. And
that's
like
exactly that's perfect, Sean. It's exactly right. And I think, but so what does this mean? What's going to happen now in right wing communities, right? This instance is going to be held up as an example of quote unquote violent left protesters, right? And I think that this frame, we've seen it creeping for a while, right? If you go back to what happened at Standing Rock, right, we had the occupation of like, you know, huge, you know, kind of area that was going to be kind of like decimated by pipelines, right? And the blockage of the pipeline blockade up there and the community that emerged in response there. And then you had laws and legislation that followed, right, that was attempting to criminalize pipeline protests. Sean has been covering this. We're happening right here in Pennsylvania, right? Attempts by Senator Regan to kind of
Senator Regan and Martin,
right, be able to kind of push through this kind of anti-pipeline protest legislation that is modeled after something that came out of Oklahoma, right? We've seen legislation that has attempted to be passed out in Oregon, right, that's saying that if you wear a mask at a protest that you can face a felony, things
or
like
your
this.
Hoodies, or if you have a hoodie on.
If you have a hoodie on, right? We saw down in North Carolina, right? If you're trying to kind of, you know, there's somebody who's blockading the street and you're driving your car and you decide, well, okay, I can't wait, and you actually hit some, you're not liable for that. We see this kind of creeping. This has been going on now, you know, since the beginning of the year, really since the election. But now, with what happened just happened in Alexandria, Virginia, right, with the shooting of several Republican lawmakers, former staff members, and lobbyists by this guy who is reportedly, right, worked with, at least, was at the very least, was a Bernie Sanders supporter, right? And by accounts
he probably volunteered with the campaign.
Right. Probably volunteered with the campaign, although the Sanders campaign is saying they have no record of it. But, you know, look, if you ever have done any political organizing for a candidate, you know that you're not necessarily signing up as a volunteer to be part of a campaign. You're volunteering at your local level and things like this. So, I mean, there's no reason to, you know, doubt that if he said he volunteered that he didn't, whatever. But then, you know, that so he volunteered for the campaign, that he held progressive views, right? All this kind of stuff. And now that shooting is kind of being conflated with anti-Trump protesting, and the kind of action that we saw right here in Harrisburg, right? And my big concern now, we're already starting to see this, right? In addition to, like, you know, the right wing doubling down, it's like, therefore, all senators and all legislators should be armed and dangerous every place they go, right? That's happening, right? You can see that coming a mile away. And just like you see it coming a mile away, that is now is going to be the attempt to push down and suppress and intimidate the anti-Trump protests by calling them violent extremists. That discourse is already out there in the right-wing media. And now I guarantee that this is going to start appearing in the Sunday talk shows, right? And in some mainstream discussions.
Oh, there's already articles going up about leftists. Terrorists, are we seeing a rise in leftist terrorist violence? And this is coming from websites like CNN.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, let's throw this frame around. You know, for 25 years, 30 years of going after gun laws, right? You know, hateful rhetoric coming from people like Sarah Palin, you know, putting bullseyes on targets on people like Gabby Giffords. Yep. Gabby Giffords' district before she was shot and almost killed, you know, through a political assassination from some right-wing conspiracy nut, you know, who had mental health issue, who was probably, you know, X, Y, and Z. 25, 30 years of doing that and the hateful rhetoric, and now they're surprised that something like this happened?
Right.
No, they're not. They're probably not surprised, but they're using us as an opportunity to go after. They're using us as an opportunity to go after protesters. But this is 25, 30 years of hateful rhetoric coming from your base.
Well, and this is also, not only is it that, right? It is 25, 30 years of a media that's been trained in this kind of false equivalence way of looking at things, right? We need to say, okay, even though, right, the overwhelming number of incidents of hate crimes, right? We saw in Charleston, right? The Charleston shooting not too long ago, right? Where like opens fire in the middle of a church after he's been sitting there with them, kind of, you know, part of service, right? This kind of massacre that takes place there. What happened down right at the Pulse Club? What, you know, I mean, like you run through the kind of Timothy McFrickin' Veigh, right? Oklahoma City bombing, right? All these right-wing militias, right, that grow out of this right-wing hate, that grow out of this kind of white supremacist background, that go out of this Klan background, all this kind of stuff, right? And somehow this instance of this guy, right, you know, shooting these guys, you know, shooting Republican lawmakers, right, not even killing any of them, not that that justifies anything, right, but that now these are the same. Right now we can see that we can have things on the same side
now,
of stuff.
We can
ask all these sexy questions that will get all the ratings about there's the left now. This is the rise of the new terrorism. I mean, this is bonkers land. But that's what this is what this media is trained to do. You need pro and you need con, and you don't need to look up a history.
The sky is blue. The sky is green. We don't know.
We don't know, right? Two sides of the story. Climate change is happening. Climate change isn't happening. We don't know. We just bring you the news, right? And that's not the news, right? I mean, you know, this is like the John Oliver thing, right? Where John Oliver is saying, okay, if we're going to have a real discussion about climate change, that we're going to actually have both sides of the story, we're going to bring on three people who are climate deniers, and we're going to bring on 97 scientists, right? Because 97% of the climate scientists believe that climate change is happening. That's what an actual weighted and even debate looks like. 97 versus three, because that's the right proportion. It's not like one person from this side, one person from that side. There's got to be a way of sorting through this kind of garbage, right, and understanding that there's material basis for this stuff, right, that the right-wing assaults and violence that is happening there, the Oath Keepers are armed and organized, right, versus this kind of guy who is clearly not right in his head, who goes out and kind of shoots these Republican lawmakers, right? No shooting is justifiable. Let's be clear about that. None of this thing is not an attempt to kind of say that this guy was okay. No. Clearly had something wrong with him, was able to get access to weapons in an easy way, right? And carried out violence as a way of solving something which should be
and
a political problem.
Instead of the discussion being about thoughts and prayers and, you know, maybe we should talk about how easy it is to get weapons. No, the first thing's coming out of the Republicans' mouths, first thing coming out of Hannity, was going after left-wing protesters. You know, using this as a way to crack down on the First Amendment rights of protesters. Going after those who are going after Madonna, going after Kathy Gifford, you know, going after people who have, you know, who spoke out against Trump over the past 6 months.
That's right.
That was the first move to learn. You were talking about this. It's the authoritarian playbook. You know, you see the video that Naomi Klein puts out the other day for The Intercept about crisis. This is that crisis. You know, this is You know, it might not be man-made. It might not be political. It could be any type of crisis. But when there's a crisis, they're going to go right for it. And this is the crisis that they're using right now.
No, Sean, you're absolutely right. I mean, like, this is the shock doctrine.
This is shock doctrine.
Exactly. This is shock doctrine in a different way. And a client is absolutely, you know, again, she says, like, she's been studying this stuff for a year and been able to follow this.
20 years.
Yes, it's a predictable pattern, right? This is a predictable pattern. And the thing is that, you know, you've heard a little bit about this, right? You know, on the left, like, you know, say the big concern about, well, you know, since Trump got elected is like, what happens if there is a terrorist attack? Right. Like, you know, meaning, right. Usually people are saying that, what they mean, if there's an international terrorist attack by someone like Al Qaeda or someone like ISIS or something like this, right. If there's that kind of thing that happens and people are saying, God help us then, because then the right wing is going to go into full war mode. Right. And our civil liberties are gone. Right. It's going to make the Iraq war, like, it's going to look at the attack on the, you know, the World Trade Center look like, you know, that was the warm up for the full, like, full thread, you know, authoritarian state. So there's no kind of discussions, but right. It doesn't have to be. And this is what was so important about what Klein had to say, is that it doesn't have to be this, you know, just global like crisis. It could be a crisis, which then becomes the ability to move certain things forward. And this is a perfect example of this. And you already see it in action. I mean, it's like, what's so frustrating about it is that watching media accounts of the responses to this, they seem absolutely incapable of being able to recognize these kind of patterns, although they stare you right in the face. The shooting is going to be the response. The shooting takes place. Now the right wing is going to ramp up its efforts to squash protests, to militarize our communities, right, and to militarize our politics, right, and justify the Oath Keepers being at these protests, right, and probably, you know, going a little easy on them if they decide to start opening up, right, and kind of, and, you know, opening up fire and kind of on protests because they felt threatened.
And then
we're going.
And then it will also allow this person who committed this assault at the LGBTQ rally, allow more people like him, give them free reign.
Yep.
To do whatever they want. And you know what? That's going to be the message coming out of this if the state decides not to press charges against this man. You know, this should not be an issue, a question of whether the state should or should not press charges. This should be a question left to a jury room or a judge.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I absolutely, right. And you know, again, that's where we should be. That's where this should be settled, right? And then, you know, I think there's also the obligation about how we talk about that and how we deal with this, and especially on the left, right? And kind of to you know, open up our political discourse in such a way that we can kind of, you know, not just grab on to the right wing media frames that have been, you know, dominated all kind of mainstream reporting about this stuff, but be able to kind of really talk about kind of power politics. Like, so for example, you know, I mean, after this incident, right, you had the LGBTQ center in Harrisburg, right, put out a statement, right, in response to kind of some of the discussion on this, which frankly should have been news too, not just, you know, this other stuff, right? I mean, they put out a statement shortly after this, which you picked up on.
Yeah, and they put a statement out there denouncing the victim blaming that's coming out of this. Let me just pull it up real quick. I have part of it right here. So, you know, they have a couple statements. There's a couple of paragraphs in. Sadly and disturbing, a violent protester assaulted one of the rally participants. The center stands in solidarity with the victim, who is a young person from our community. The center recognizes that the person who committed this assault also brought into the rally a violent message, which included a sign that disparaged immigrants and which included a verbally calling for the murder of LGBTQ people, specifically citing the June 2016 massacre at Pulse nightclub. Mm-hmm. It has been expressed by some community members that the assault was somehow warranted or deserved because the victim grabbed the protester's sign. The senator stands against any and all of these victim-blaming responses. No one deserves to be physically assaulted, period. We believe that we, as a community, have productive and respectful discussions of how to strategically challenge those who harm our communities, how to sustain ourselves for long-term social justice work, and how to equip ourselves and our communities with knowledge of our rights when engaging in public demonstrations. We expect and respect that LGBTQ plus people have varied perspective on these topics. Within these conversations, however, the center does not accept the premise that grabbing a protester's hateful sign warrants a physical assault.
there you go. I don't know how much more clear we needed to have it. I mean, that's the perfect response to this.
Yeah.
Man. So, I mean, I don't know, Sean. I don't even know where we go from here. You know, I mean, I think that we're seeing...
We're living in an alternate facts universe is what we're living in now. And this is exactly what someone at the bar said. You know, we're talking, you know, we're living in the world of alternative facts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's what Kellyanne Conway said, but, you know, we're living in a world of alternative facts. And that's going to lead us down a very dark road if we don't organize and fight back.
No, I agree. You know, and I was thinking a lot about this past week. You know, I reread 1984 a while ago, you know, and, you know, it's interesting how when you kind of reread things, they, you know, different things stand out at different times. But one of the things that really stood out to me this go round, and, you know, connected up with some other stuff I've been kind of reading and thinking about, is the role that kind of disorientation plays in you know, the rise of authoritarianism and so on. Like I remember actually there was, you know, back when I was in college, we were doing solidarity work with folks in El Salvador, Nicaragua, because, you know, our government at the time under President Reagan and then the first Bush, you know, were funding Contras and right-wing paramilitaries and death squads in Central America to prevent, you know, like, you know, the rise of communism, right? Same kind of crap. But so we're funding all this money down. So we're doing this solidarity work. And one of the things that that emerged, right, again, it was a document that was leaked and began to get circulated around in communities, was basically the CIA disinformation manuals, right, that were being used in the communities in Central America as a way to kind of like overtly disorient, right, the population. So they would be less susceptible to, you know, community organizing and things like this, right? You basically got people to the point where they weren't sure what to believe, right? And when you get people to that point where they're disoriented, right, through all this disinformation and misinformation and you know, the false equivalences and all this kind of stuff, you have a media infrastructure that feeds into that, where people can no longer determine what is true and what is not. We're in a bad space because it leaves open for the people, the strong hand, to come in and say, this is what is true. The Donald Trump statement that, you know, only I am the only one that can get us out of this mess. So it's pretty crazy. Well, Sean, I think, you know, so we're in kind of our dark descent here into this discussion. So anything else you want to add for this before we try to find some light at the end of the tunnel?
Let's look at some happy times.
Yeah, let's look at some happy times. All right, I will add to that before we go to the break. One little bit of happy time. You all can't see this obviously on the podcast, but standing right behind me now is my daughter, who just graduated from kindergarten yesterday, and she's got a big smile and a rainbow shirt on. So that's going to be my little bit of happiness to take us into the break. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I will be back with Sean right after this for some, hopefully, a little bit more fun news to close out a segment. It's Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be back right after this.
We are the resistance. Ah, we are living proof. They will know what happened. If they don't tell the truth, we will rise up tall, gather in the streets of every state capital. We will rise up tall, the aching of our feet won't slow us down, no, not at all. This is how it all gets started. Ah, secret votes behind closed doors. While they mock got in the closet. Ah, getting richer off the poor. We will rise up tall. gather in the streets of every state capital. We will rise up tall. The aching of our feet won't slow us down, no, not at all. Throw our healthcare in the garbage. Ah, blame it on Planned Parenthood. They must know what they have started. Ah, we won't be misunderstood. We will rise up tall. Gather in the streets of every state capital. We will rise up tall. The aching of our feet won't slow us down, no, not at all. The aching of our feet won't slow us down.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. So one of the things we forgot to mention, Sean just reminded me on the break, was what just happened in terms of the media and the Senate. So, Sean, just kind of remind us of that before we get to some fun things.
The Senate Rules Committee inside, you know, the National Senate, the National U.S. Senate, the Senate Rules Committee, they passed a resolution banning journalists from videotaping and recording interviews inside the hallways of the Capitol. And if they're to do so, if they're to get interviews with these senators, these Republican senators, obviously, they will have to have permission first to do this. You know, this is deeply disturbing in response to what happened with Greg Gianfort, you know, who walked into Ben Jacobs went to Gianforte's campaign office and demanded questions being answered before he was physically assaulted. You know, also this comes in the wake of the arrest of a journalist for throwing questions out there at Secretary Tom Price. As he was walking through the Capitol, you know, and all this guy was doing, all this journalist from West Virginia was doing was asking questions and persisted. So now they have to have permission in order to record these journalists inside the Capitol hallways. And, you know, frankly, I think it's time for the journalists as a whole, as a community, to really just let tall man speak, you know, and just say, F you, we're going to record anyway.
Right.
Like, it's time. It's time to start being confrontational, you know, and not going along with these rules that are being changed. You know, start taking direct action and start forcing the issue. If it takes someone getting arrested for asking questions, then so be it. You know, start forcing that issue. Because if, you know, you again, go back to that book that was you were talking about earlier. If journalists as a profession allowed this to happen, then you automatically lose, you know, you lose, you know, standing up against authoritarianism.
Yeah, you lose and you lose big time, right? I mean, and it's not the kind of stuff that it's easy to get back for. And so once you let that genie out of the bottle, it's pretty nuts.
I mean, one of the things that like people are saying, you know, you have reports coming out like, oh, well, this investigation will undo Trump. You know, all this wishful thinking. No, they are solidifying one party rule at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what they are doing. They are solidifying one party rule within the government. And
well, you know, and you know, that's one of the things on that, you know, on tyrannies is beware and be wary of one party rule. I mean, it's like, there you go.
You know, they're not completely outlawing the Democratic Party from existing, but they are fortifying their structures into solidifying their power, permanent one party rule power. And this is what's happening.
There you have it, folks. One more step towards authoritarianism, which is why I was glad to see, and this is my segue if you're missing it right now, folks, Elon Musk once again out there in front, basically giving his vision of a sustainable city on Mars. Because I think that's our only way out at this point. The only way out at this point is, you know, if we don't get our organizing together quickly enough, well, okay, that's going to be the next bet.
I did see somewhere it is a lot cheaper than once previously thought to have a colony on the moon. So,
It is. However, as Musk said, and there's a kind of recent announcement, this was all reported in Forbes this week, that, you know, colony on the moon, Sean, just won't be as fun. Literally, he said, yeah, look, you know, you got Martian gravity is like what 37% of Earth or something like this. And it's got an atmosphere, right? So it's a little bit better. Moon, kind of desolate, not a lot of resources around there. You know,
no gravity.
It's fun. No gravity, really, to speak of.
No atmosphere.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, why do that? Mars is so much more fun. And they actually have the plan. I mean, you know, again, what's remarkable about this is that the plan is actually SpaceX wants to start kind of making this happen. They want to put a one of their Dragon spacecraft. They're going to send it to Mars in 2020. That was originally slated for next year. But, you know, again, like space is hard. And they're looking to, you know, send it there in 2020. And they're designing a spacecraft that would basically allow, I think it's like 100 people at a time to kind of fly out to Mars. Right. And that's kind of pretty crazy. And we've already seen some of the advances that's been happening with SpaceX over the past couple of years. They finally have got their reusable spacecrafts are almost routine at this point. They just not only did they reuse the boosters and are successfully landing the boosters like repeatedly, but now they've actually sent up a craft to the space station, returned it, and then sent it up again. So they're reusing the actual the crafts themselves, and that is a huge advance, at least in terms of if you think it's worthwhile at all to be headed to Mars. What's kind of crazy about this is they're saying that, you know, what the plan is basically if you send these folks to Mars, right, you send people to Mars or make it affordable, right? Because right now, if you use the Apollo style stuff, you send up a big rocket and that kind of stuff, you're talking about a $10 billion per person, right, to send people out to Mars. SpaceX, their goal, right, is to bring this down to basically about $200,000 per person. And basically saying in order to make a city sustainable on Mars, you need about 1 million people. So you're obviously talking about something that would take decades in order to do. To accomplish 100 people at a time, but you know, you start building multiple spacecrafts and things like this. They want in space refueling stations. They want to manufacture stuff actually on Mars to do this. You know, it does seem to be, you know, a little bit of space fantasy stuff here, but it's happening. And you know, again, one of my fascinations with this is that on the one hand. Is, you know, just I love science fiction, right? And this is kind of like science fiction for real and all that kind of stuff. But then on the other hand, it's like there's a big question. I'm one who tends to believe that this is going to happen one way or another, right? So then really the big question becomes on what terms, right? Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars, is still in my mind the best example of thinking about these questions. About does Mars become a colony? Does it become just, you know, a tripling down on extractivism? Does it become about, you know, galactic capitalism, right? Or are there other visions of how this would happen and what and the terms are? And what kind of impact will that happen back on our own planet? Now, if you look at what's happening in terms of our water crisis as part of climate change, what's happening out on the West Coast, right? There's already communities that are being built on the top of basically emptied out kind of water basins, right? So you've had these kind of huge underground water wells that have basically been exhausted. They've been pulled out of the earth to kind of feed the West Coast and feed the kind of the desert, basically. There's basically communities that have been built that are currently empty, right? But they're luxury homes, gated communities that are built around these underground basins that are being filled with water, right? In preparation for, the loss of water on the West Coast. And what does that mean? Is that means there's already plans in the works to have a place for rich people to go to have their own water supply when the water runs out for the rest of folks, right? So you got no money, right? You're screwed when it comes to your access to water. Check out this book. It's a great book. It's called The Price of Thirst. which documents some of these kind of developments. So you think about that was already happening here as a particular logic of development. And now we've got these discussions about the colonization of Mars. What are the terms on which that's going to happen? So, these are interesting questions, right? If we're going to talk so seriously about galactic capitalism, right, or galactic anti-capitalism, if you will, what does that mean as we are literally going full speed ahead towards the settlement of Mars? But the one thing that I am happy about is that we're going to find out fairly soon, Sean, about whether one of the biggest engineering problems is going to be solved. Because if you're going to have this thing, the biggest question for any kind of sustainable city is going, are you going to be able to brew beer in space? Right. And I kid you not.
I hope you get the original gravity correct.
Well, I kid you not. There is a group of engineering students from the University of California in San Diego that are working on a device that can brew beer in space. And there's a Google has this thing that's called an XPRIZE, and basically, but it's about landing stuff on the moon, and it's this kind of global competition, landing things on the moon and conducting experiments and all that. Anyways, there's a team in this, which is kind of this Indian-based company that won part of an XPRIZE, that they're going to be carrying experiments to the moon. And this group of engineering students, the University of California, San Diego, basically won the right to have their device brought to the moon, right, as part of this space launch. And so I'll give you here's how it's set up. And this is from this site called VinePair. But it would be obvious. It would obviously be the first beer ever brewed in space. The experiment will test yeast in space for things like pharmaceuticals and bread and beer. The idea for space beer all started over a few laughs and I can only guess a few beers. And this is it. Quote. We all appreciate the craft of beer, and some of us own our own home brewing kits. Nika Ashari, a fifth-year student at University of California, San Diego, says in a statement, when we heard that there was an opportunity to design an experiment that would go up in India's moon lander, we thought we could combine our hobby with a competition by focusing on the viability of yeast in outer space. The space brewery wouldn't count as a microbrewery or even a picobrewery. It's the size of a soda can split into three sections, right? So they're actually going to be going up. They're going to kind of be testing this stuff. And then we're actually going to get some news about whether or not, or what is it actually going to take, not whether or not, because I believe that they can do this, what it's actually going to be able to take in order to brew beer in space. So there you have it, Sean.
Are they going to have like wild yeast floating through space that you can like...
Eventually.
that you can use like wild space dust, like Britannomyces, to use up there?
Yeah, well, the spacecraft actually looks like it is designed after Belgian monasteries. So you're going to have the big open flaps that are going to open themselves up to the wild yeast of space to brew their beer.
Filled with doses of radiation.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always the downside to that, right? So anyways, that's my feel good stuff for the week. That's all I got, man. So what's up? What's up for this week for you? For kind of plans, fun, any of that kind of stuff?
Nothing really. I'll be working all weekend. Earlier this week, I visited a brewery in the area. I think we talked about this once before. It's called Evergreen, and it's out in Camp Hill. I stopped in there to get a growler filled of their Juice Juicy, and I ran into a couple people I bartend for, Pizza Boy, a couple customers there, and it ended up staying like three or four beers. Totally shot my Tuesday afternoon. And the place is really nice. Definitely recommend going out there and get their Juice Juicy IPA. It's probably one of the best beers they do. It is the best beer they do. And it's becoming one of my favorite IPAs out there right now.
Man, that's awesome. You know, one of the things that my wife and I went to, you know, we've been plugging this on the podcast. We went to Cheers for Choice this past weekend, which was up in Allentown at Fegley's Allentown Brewworks. And, you know, it was a 100-year anniversary. It was a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. And it was awesome kind of being up there. And in addition to drinking, obviously, stuff from Allentown Brewworks, they had some kind of local distilleries there. And I'm going to look it up here while we're on here to see if I can't remember the name. I'm just drawing a blank. But have you ever had the stuff from Colonial Meadery in Allentown?
I have not.
I actually had a couple of their bottles from stuff before, and it's fantastic. So they were actually on site. They were on site actually had samples of their kind of mead. And there was the other distillery. I only have to put it in the show notes if I can't find it, but it was a from Quakertown, actually. Let me just see if I can look it up before we get off. Quakertown Distillery. Faber. That's it. Called Faber. Faber Easy Drinking Liquors. You can look at FaberEasyDrinking.com. They were there and they had samples of, you know, they had a full slot of stuff, which apparently they're going to opening a tasting room this fall out in Quakertown. But now he's starting to show up in stores. It's, you know, again, it's in Quakertown. They've been going for a couple of years. We tried some of their stuff. That is absolutely fantastic. So if you are in the Quakertown area or just look for it in your, you know, local liquor stores. I mean, Faber has got some great stuff. And the guy I talked to, God, he's probably in his early 30s, maybe. Really cool guy, very invested in the community. And out there and kind of support that. So that was kind of some cool stuff. So Colonial Meadery, just the best mead around. Faber, Easy Drinking Liquors, check them out. And, you know, hopefully that over the next couple of weeks that we're going to hear about, you know, some new beers that are coming out. I know here they are coming out with some things of Free Will. And I'm going to be hopefully at least a couple of days this week, I'm going to try to make it out to Bucks County Brewing. Have you ever been there, Sean?
I have not.
So have you heard about them?
I have not, no.
Yeah, they're up in Tinicum, I think, and just off 611. And I've been by where their stuff is. I just haven't had the time to go there. I'm going to try to get out there at least one day this week. I'll just try out their stuff. So maybe we'll have a report for next week's podcast.
So, nice.
Yeah, so anything else for the good of the order, sir?
No, that's it, I believe.
No, that's it. I think we're just gonna have to keep on pulling on some of this stuff, Sean. Pulling on some of these issues and try to unpack them from here and there. You know, it's like in the onslaught. And I'm glad. You know, we should say Sean thought it was a good idea that we really kind of focus in on some of these questions today, because you know it's easy to get lost in the midst of everything that is going on a national level and the kind of nonstop, you know, media parade, you know, and lose focus on some of the really important things that are happening in our communities that we need to talk about. So anyways, we'll come back to it next week. Until then, I wish you a happy Father's Day weekend for any Father's Day that are out there, or other Father's Days that are out there, other fathers that are out there, good week ahead, and let's hope for some good weather and some good fun, and we'll get back to the fight. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Talk to you next week.
See ya!